You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality. Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and this week I am joined by Mark.
Hello.
And Greg.
Hello, friends.
And we are here to, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of perhaps one of the most, if not the most beloved Doctor Who story ever, arguably, perhaps. The Capes of Androzani. It's a bloody masterpiece. It's fantastic. And it's 40, and we're going to do parts one and two. We're going to do a commentary on parts one and two today, and then we will return with parts three and four in the very near future. So it's the first of a two-parter podcast episode, this, I guess. So we'll get moving pretty quickly on it. Listeners at home, we will give you a sort of countdown to press play. So if you wish, you can follow the episode with us. But before we do that, let's just get some, I guess, initial takes on the Caves of Androzani. So just initial thoughts, you know, memories of first seeing it, that kind of thing. Mark, you go first.
Well, the Fifth Doctor is my favourite Doctor. He's my childhood Doctor. I'm old enough to remember significant chunks of the Peter Davison era, and I do indeed remember this going out at the time, although only, I think I only have memories of part one. I don't know why I missed the rest of it. I think I maybe didn't realize it was his regeneration story or something, but I just remember that pervading sense of doom, like that really, you know, well, Graham Harper managed to achieve in that story, coming off the screen in waves at me, you know, just hitting my six-year-old mind, like, what is this? This feels different. You know, I don't think I knew it was a regeneration story, but I could just feel there was something different and more, I don't know what the word is, like more was at stake. And it's that impression stayed with me so vividly all these years. And of course, then I went back when I, you know, became like a fully fledged card-carrying fan in the 90s. I bought it in VHS, and for quite a while it was my favorite story. I was absolutely convinced it would remain my favorite story, and then Castrovalva overtook it. But it's up there. It's what could be said about it that hasn't been said already. It is a masterpiece, like you say.
Yeah, it really is just. It must have been amazing, sort of watching it on broadcast. And I guess is there a sense of maybe, you know, this is what Doctor Who could be?
Yeah.
You know, it makes everything around it feel like something's missing. And season 21 is up there. It's one of my favourites. I absolutely love it. Couple of flawed stories, being generous, I suppose, there. But there's a really, really great run in there. And Androzani is kind of the end of that run, and it feels like a big epic finale. And the mad thing is, it's not a season finale at all. Greg, what are your thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, I have kind of a similar history with it. Of course, I'm in the US, so I couldn't watch Doctor Who on broadcast, but I probably saw Androzani first when I was six or seven or something like that in the late 1980s. And it's a story that I've appreciated more and more, like, as I've gotten older, because I remember vaguely, you know, seeing it as a kid. And I mean, I enjoyed it. It was good. But, you know, when you're that young, you don't really, because it's a very adult story. It's a very mature story. And when you're a kid, you don't really understand like why something like that is good. It's like Mark said, you just have this kind of sense that this is different. This is good. But then, you know, I got a little older and then I started recognizing like, oh man, like Peter Davison's really good in this, or, you know, or just all of the acting across the board. And then like, I started getting more interested in film and TV and so on, you know, as I got into my teenage years. And then you watch it again and then you realize like, wow, this is really well directed, especially for, you know, a mid 1980s BBC studio production. Like, this is really inventive and creative. And yeah, I mean, it seems like every time I go back to it, I find something new to appreciate. So if I find something new during this commentary, I will definitely let you know. But yeah, it's a classic. It's deserved to be a classic. Everyone loves it for good reason. I love it. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this.
It might be the closest Doctor Who's ever been to being Blake Seven as well. I think it kind of, do you know what I mean? It kind of feels like it's, there's that kind of crossover vibe. I don't know, just something of it's just hard edge. Just really feels like it could just, it's like Doctor Who's momentarily stepped into the Blake Seven universe. And then obviously Eric Sayward kind of picks up on that later and mutates it into something else. But just, yeah, for four episodes, it almost just feels like Doctor Who and Blake Seven are just like a little Venn diagram overlap there. And it's perfect. And it's never quite perfected the same way again, because it's always consciously done after that. Does that make sense?
I think that's probably down to what you were both saying about it having that more sort of adult tone, it being a much more grown-up story than the normal. And I think Blake Seven generally was a little bit more grown-up, a little bit more serious, and certainly darker than your average Doctor Who. And, you know, it's elevated just, I think, by that. And then everything else just seems like a bonus. Graham Harper's direction, and as you pointed out, Davison's performance is just something else in this. Like, he's never bad as the Doctor. I never don't enjoy Davison as the Doctor, but in this he's on fire. And it's, there are hints, I think throughout all of season 21 there are hints of this is how Davison actually wanted to play it, but wasn't allowed for seasons 19 and 20. I think in Frontios, Planet of Fire, and well, I suppose Frontios, Resurrection of the Daleks, Planet of Fire, and this, we perhaps get Davison's version of the Fifth Doctor as opposed to Sayward's or JNT's or whoever. And I think it's a definite improvement. I really do think.
Holding off on doing it that way works really well, because they're able to up the sense of desperation. Like, he basically becomes in his last story this guy who he's tried to be nice, if you like. I mean, I know the Fifth Doctor's got his be sarcastic edge to him, but he's basically the nice Doctor, you know, and he's tried it so many times and failed, you know, to basically, and you almost just sense this guy who's reached the end of his rope, and like the universe has just become too cynical a place for him to kind of function anymore. And you know, the universe is ready for a harder Doctor to come in, and he just sort of, I don't know, like you sense that desperation in him.
So what we're going to do is we're going to watch episode one, and then we're going to pause it at the end of episode one and have a tiny little break, and then we'll go into episode two. So that's what we're heading towards now. So we'll provide a countdown for pressing play. I know that you guys have got it ready to go. I've got it ready to go. So we're going to press play, and we are going to start our commentary. So if you are joining us, if you're watching it at home, get iPlayer ready, get your DVD ready to go, whatever you're watching it on, and we will be pressing play in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's go. It feels kind of strange to be going into the final story of a Doctor, and it's the theme, the title sequence that they've had throughout their whole era, because John Pertwee and Tom Baker got new title sequences in the final season, so it's quite strange to see the same titles as Castrovalva.
It's only three of the classic Doctors had the same title sequence the whole time, right? Hartnell, Davison, and McCoy?
Yes. I think Colin Baker had the same sequence, but different music.
Yeah, right.
But even there, you know, it kind of does fall into the same category, that final story being a little different.
And here we immediately have, you know, a departure from the norm, because that must be the widest shot for exiting the TARDIS we've ever had. Look at that panorama there.
It's kind of like 80-yard voiceover dialogue too to start, which is interesting.
Yeah, it gives it a really interesting feel.
It's slightly odd to have a story that starts, certainly a classic story that starts with the TARDIS landing and the regular stepping out. Most stories will have some kind of preamble, character getting killed off by an unseen monster, that kind of thing. This just kind of starts really low key. It's the two leads walking out the TARDIS and having a bit of a chat. Where do you stand on the they barely know each other or they've had millions of Big Finish adventures between Planet of Fire and this?
Well, to my mind, it doesn't stretch credibility that they've had the kind of RMM run of stories in between. I think some people would say, oh, the way he's talking to her here is as though they've only just met. But I don't know. I think there's room for retconning that. There's nothing there that's overtly just getting to know each other. I know there's a kind of romance to the idea of he sacrifices his life for someone he's just met, and it is in a sense a shame to lose that. But I think, you know, I'd rather have the fullest canon of the Fifth Doctor that we can have. So I personally don't really have a problem sticking the RMM stories, and it didn't go on for too long, let's face it. So
I really like that era, that RMM stuff.
Oh yeah, it's really good. I mean, there's like Mark just said, there's nothing here that says those stories couldn't have happened. Like it works. It's just, I mean, to me, this is the second story with the two of them, and you know, back then, like this is clearly intended to be their like first separate trip together, because that's the first one we've seen on screen. Like that, I think that's how you're supposed to interpret it here. But I mean, yeah, I mean, you can easily retcon it. I mean, I'm not offended by that.
Yeah, I mean, Perry's outfit there does sort of clearly indicate that it's supposed to be straight after, but
right,
you know, she could have put that back on because she thought they were going to the seaside or whatever. She does talk about the tide being out.
I mean, I like to think that at some point between every story in season 19, the characters all sort of wash the clothes and get changed and just happen to be in the same costume for every time an adventure happens. Either that or Adric's pyjamas would have got very smelly.
First appearance of the story's one possible flaw. Yeah, it was the old magma beast.
Every great story has something like a magma beast.
Yeah. And I think it's very obvious that Graham Harper's aware of that, and he tries to keep it in the shadows and off camera as much as possible.
Yeah.
Did you just notice the old, I think it's called microphony effect there, where the horizontal lines just came on the screen there when they shot the bullets? I think that was just an unavoidable thing in those days, where if you had live, you know, loud sounds in the studio, the wires would vibrate inside the cameras, and that's what caused that little jump in the picture. But nice. They haven't sort of managed to rectify that in any subsequent version, I don't think.
It's more noticeable on the cliffhanger to this episode as well.
Yeah.
And there we have it. We, for all intents and purposes, the Fifth Doctor is now dead. He's come into contact with the Spectrox. That's it. I love how what happens to make him regenerate just starts. Well, it's at the start of the story. It's almost straight away.
Right. And I mean, it's clearly there to set something up, but at the same time, it's like, it feels so inconsequential.
Yeah. The way the Doctor and Perry just brush it off, carry on, bigger things to worry about.
Yeah. And like even though we can't hear it right now, because we're watching this on mute, with subtitles, Roger Limb's music is just superb in this. I think, isn't it supposedly the case that he was asked to go back and rework his original score? Because what he submitted was much more in line with what he'd originally kind of been doing for the series, you know, in the other seasons. And then Harper said, no, can you just give it an extra doomy quality or something? And then he came back with the score that you actually hear, and it's doing a hell of a lot of heavy lifting in this. Not that the performances and the direction aren't great, but it just saturates the whole thing as well.
We're past it a little bit, but I just want to say I love the scene where he explains what the celery's for.
Oh, yeah. That's great. I know there's sort of two schools of thought on that. There's the people who say, oh, I wish he'd never explained the celery because it's just a quirk that he you know, it's just an eccentricity that doesn't require explaining. And then there's the ones who say, oh, no, I'm glad there was. I think you can have your cake and eat it on that one.
Oh, yeah. Just the way Davison says, I eat the celery, is just so good.
Yeah. A little bit of flippancy.
Yes. These look vaguely like Star Trek uniforms.
Yeah. Here comes old salad cream for the first time. With an exquisite side chip to rival Davison's own. I think those guys were, Davison and this actor, Robert Glenister, were quite good mates. So I think, because they worked on a sitcom together, and he's maybe been asked, is there anybody you want to be in your final story? And he says, I'll get him in. You know, he's a good mate. But he suits that part so well.
He came back to Doctor Who as well, didn't he? He was in the Tesla episode.
Oh, yeah, Jodie Whittaker one.
I can't remember its name. It's the something
Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror.
That's the one, Nikola Tesla's Night of Terror. Knew it was a long title. I've always liked to think we'd get his brother into Doctor Who at some point anyway, but it's not happened yet.
Yeah, that's got to happen.
Preferably in an episode with John Sims Master. One for Life on Mars fans there.
It must take some confidence as a writer to come up with these sort of honorary titles like Crow, Timon, and Trow, Morgus, and stuff like that. You kind of think, how do you write that down on paper without thinking, is this too silly? Like, what does this sound? How does this hit the ear? You know, but you just have to commit to something, I guess, and say, look, it's an alien planet. These are the honoraries.
It's something that Robert Holmes was brilliant at. Just little nibbles of world building, tiny little things, but it just makes you feel like you're somewhere that has an identity.
He was the master of it, wasn't he?
Davison really is brilliant in this.
There's just a level of commitment here to the performances that you don't always see in classic Doctor Who. Like, not to say that acting's bad in other episodes, but man, like everyone in this is just so like in their character. I love it.
Yeah, because this guy here is so humorless. This would be the point where the Doctor would normally kind of begin to win round the skeptical military forces that are surrounding him, but there's just no mission of it here. They're too beleaguered, and it's just too cynical a world. Even he's not going to survive it.
Right. He's stumbled in. I mean, the whole season is about this, but he's stumbled into, like you were mentioning Blake Seven earlier, but he's stumbled into not a Doctor Who episode.
That's it. That's exactly right.
Like, because you can see, like, he tries to do all of that stuff. Like, he's trying to win him over. He's trying to put himself in the position where, okay, they think we committed murder, but now I've talked them onto my side and I'm going to help out for the rest of the story. And it just doesn't work. Like, at no point does anyone, like, trust him or take him seriously. Like, the Doctor's kind of a peripheral character to the actual plot here.
And it's kind of crucial what he's just said there. He doesn't feel well himself. He's off his game. He's actually getting physically sick. And it's kind of like, I remember Stephen Moffat saying that he wanted Matt Smith's first story to be him basically trying to do a normal Doctor Who story whilst suffering the flu. You sort of sense that here. It's like the stakes are high anyway, and then he's battling this illness, and he's just completely off balance, even though he's trying all his usual tricks.
Quite like the effect there, the video call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You see the back of the head as well, don't you, at some point?
Yeah.
I can't remember if it's
that's where he here. Walks around it. That's so cool.
Oh yeah.
Like, it's a super simple effect, but it's very, there you go. Back of the head. It's very, very well done here.
And that's all Graham Harper. Like, nobody else would have pushed for that.
John Normington, I think it is so good as Morgus.
Hmm.
Yeah.
There's never been... there's probably never been in the entire history of Doctor Who a more obviously insincere character. He's not even trying to be sincere. He just pays lip service to things with the deadpan manner of a man who just is defying anyone to challenge him on it, you know? And his PA there... Timon eventually does call him out on it, but he just knows he's in this position of power where he can get away with absolutely outrageous behavior. And there'll be a bit of soliloquizing from him in a while. I can't remember if it's this episode or next, but that's a really unusual touch.
It works because he's a very, very Shakespearean villain. Here we go.
Hey, you're like straight to camera, nearly. Well, it is straight to camera.
I mean, Something else. It's an exaggerated performance in many ways, but it's deliberately so. Like, again, the commitment to just nailing that, not just that deadpan, but like this, the anger behind his eyes and so on.
These flashes here are torturing the tube cameras with the bright colors there.
Does a very good job of making what's pretty much a stock military, futuristic military, BBC military base type thing look interesting. Like this is a very boring set. This is one of the most boring sets we've ever seen in Doctor Who. It's, you know, look at this. It's a white wall with a couple of IKEA lights at the top, and that's it.
That's true, but it really gets across that sense of you know, been bunkered down and just, you know, everything's so, yeah, it's so basic and so functional. And actually, those uniforms are really well thought through, because the you know, they can't wear smart military uniforms because they're just down in those caves, so they have to look a bit like potholers. But everything's slightly crinkled and beaten up, but they still have to kind of maintain a bit of military decorum. So they've struck a really nice balance there aesthetically, I think.
I love this two shot.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's not just like the camera positions, you know, the use of light and shadow in this is so good. And it's, that's almost impossible to pull off in this kind of filming environment.
It's one of the very, very, very few Davisons that isn't overlit as well.
Right. Another one being Warriors of the Deep.
Well, can you imagine if Warriors of the Deep had this kind of lighting?
Right.
Like, it instant.
And no pantomime horse.
Well, but it would be instantly improved. It would make, I mean, the Murker might have half a chance of looking relatively sinister in, you know, a darker set lit in a darker way. It's the fact that it's in the most overlit, white, shiny corridor ever.
Right. And it doesn't fit the tone of the story either. That's the thing. Like,
but yeah. Yeah, Warriors of the Deep should look like this. You know, I've always wondered with this story, because obviously, you know, the Doctor has pretty much no influence on events whatsoever. It's just a series of horrible things that the Doctor and Perry happen to be involved in. I often wonder how a different Doctor would kind of deal with this situation. You know, would there be a different outcome if it was the Fourth Doctor, for example, or...
Well, I think the one you need to look at is Colin Baker, because, like, the whole idea of Twin Dilemma and, you know, his character is that he's the Doctor who's supposed to be able to function in stories like this. Like, he's a Doctor who's designed for the Eric Sayward, you know, brutal nihilistic universe. Now, I mean, I think it would just boil down, in this particular story, I think it would just boil down to him yelling a lot. I don't know that it would really make that much difference, but I think that's where you got to start anyway.
I do think Pertwee had just talked himself into more trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this story would end worse for Pertwee than it did for Davison.
Yeah, it's like how Troughton ends up against the wall after one episode of the War Games.
Yeah.
Now, the one Doctor who definitely wouldn't survive this would be Hartnell, because all that running at the end, he's just not going to make it.
He'd send Ian.
Yeah.
Just hear the dialogue, can't you? I can't be crawling through those caves, my boy. Off you go.
I'm thinking more of the bit where he escapes the ship after... Oh, spoilers, of course, but then if anybody was listening to this, not having watched it, they'd been saying, wouldn't they?
I can see him doing a brilliant version of the "not going to let you stop me now" speech. That last shot with somebody walking into the cell, I almost wish it wasn't there.
I know what you mean.
I know it's just a little shot and you just see somebody walking in, but I wish there'd have been no hint whatsoever that something had happened before that cliffhanger.
But I think you probably don't really consciously take it in on the first watch, we've seen it so many times that it stands out more.
Yeah. I think the first time I saw it, there was all the talk about Android duplicates and stuff, and then there was that shot, and then by the time you get to the end of the episode, you sort of go, ah, yeah, it's not them. But just no hint whatsoever, no idea at all of how they would escape that cliffhanger, because there are a million cliffhangers that are somebody saying, shoot them. There are hardly anywhere the guns actually go off. And I genuinely think it's one of the best cliffhangers in classic Doctor Who at all. It's just incredible.
Yeah, or it'll be like, again, War Games, where there is gunfire, but it turns out it wasn't the guns of the executioners, you know. Here you actually see them shoot what you think is the Doctor and Perry.
So, yeah. And it's a shot in profile, so you see the bullets spray from the guns.
I once showed this to a friend, and he was he was clutching a pile of books at the end of this episode and dropped them. The cliffhanger actually made him drop the books.
Wow.
It's fantastic. Yeah.
This president here, the Presidium must be really close by, because I think he visits him something like four times in the course of the story. He keeps popping in and out. And
so look at how well blocked that shot is, like between the two of them over the shoulder. Oh, it's so good.
Oh, I love this when it pulls back and they're just facing each other, because that's a little hint.
Oh, man. Oh, God, I love that too.
Yeah. I mean, it could be just them preparing themselves mentally, but it's or sort of making a silent goodbye, but it's with hindsight, it's the android factor, you know. It is, they're just these dead automatons until somebody walks in. There's our old friend.
So we even get a reveal of the villain at the end of the episode, and in like any other Doctor Who story, that was the cliffhanger. Yeah. Shara's Jack turning round to the camera laughing, and we can see his masked face. Mm. That's the cliffhanger in any other Doctor Who, but this just has this absolutely
Phantom of the Opera glory. Yeah.
Yeah. This whole sequence is just fantastic. The music's fantastic, the drums, I don't want my Doctor Who to be this bleak every week, but
no.
Just getting it this bleak, getting it this dark, and making it this good is a real achievement, particularly at the time it was made.
You need all those unsung average episodes to let one like this really sing, you know, to stand out from the crowd.
And it's, as I said before, it's in the middle of, well, towards the end of, a very, very good season, very good run. You know, take Warriors of the Deep and Twin Dilemma out. Oh, there we go. Take Warriors of the Deep and Twin Dilemma out, and it's an incredible run of stories of Awakening, Frontios, Resurrection, Planet of Fire, and this.
And I mean, Warriors of the Deep, though it's, you know, it didn't come off in the execution, like thematically, it's such a crucial story to the season. I mean, like that's really where you start to get like that great performance out of Davison. Like at the end, there should have been another way. Like the agony that he puts into that line, it's such an eye opener from those previous 2 years.
So we're going to pause it at the end of the credits here and just prepare ourselves for part two. So if for whatever reason you've fallen out of sync with us or anything like that, it's an opportunity to just refresh. But yeah, Graham Harper, perhaps the best.
Hard to argue otherwise.
He's got to be up there in the top five anyway.
I mean, especially once he came back for the, you know, the modern series, like.
Yeah. Has he retired now? I think he has, hasn't he?
I can't imagine he'd be back for another go at Doctor Who anyway. Yeah, he's what a game changer.
All right, then, let's move on to part two. So we'll do another press play countdown. So pressing play on the beginning of part two in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I just love this title sequence so much. That theme arrangement as well is my all-time favorite.
Yep. Peter Howell. I will set my card out. 60 years of Doctor Who, this is the best Doctor Who theme song.
Agreed.
I used to not like it, and it's grown on me over the years. And yeah, it's very, very good. It's certainly one of the best, if not the best. I really like the trial version. Not many do.
Oh, I love it too. Basically, the 80s can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned, but a lot of fans would turn their heads towards being horror at that statement.
Oh, I mean, I love the McCoy theme too.
There are flaws, of course, but it's just my favorite era. I just love it unconditionally in the way that only somebody who's grown up with that as their form of Doctor Who can do.
Oh, this cliffhanger. I know I keep going on about it, but it's you see the guns fire.
Yeah. And then here in the reprise, you actually see the bullets hit them, or their computer graphic equivalent thereof, too. You didn't even see that in the actual cliffhanger.
I'm really glad that's not in the actual cliffhanger, because it just lingers on the guns firing for a little bit longer, and it's a fantastic final shot, even if it's ruined by the lines created by the noise. It is a fantastic shot.
Never trust a man in a ponytail.
See, I love the performance, because right when he challenges him on closing the plants, like, he glances off to the side for just a second, like gathering himself, and then he goes right back into his deadpan, totally in control reading. Oh, yes, focus shift.
This guy, Christopher Gable, isn't that the name of the actor? He was a dancer, wasn't he? I can understand, you know, they wanted that. He had to convey so much with physicality because he's so hidden. But even just that one eye, like, you can see everything that's going on in his head. It's a really powerful performance.
Isn't the story that they wanted David Bowie?
Supposedly, yeah. They were never going to get him, like, but good try.
I mean, he would have been great.
Yeah.
But he would. But it's one of those parts where, like, because Christopher Gable did it so well, you just can't think of anyone else in the role now.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, in Harper's other story, they allegedly offered the part of the mutant to was it John Gielgud? So it was some really acclaimed actor was offered this part.
Oh, it was it Charlton Heston, someone like that?
It was somebody like super famous. It would have been the equivalent of saying to Jacoby, like, do you want to play third mutant from the left or something? But I think that was a JNT decision and not a Graham Harper one. He'd have had more sense than to suggest that.
I love the design of the androids.
Yeah.
Like androids in Doctor Who can come off a little bit cartoony, the sort of Android Invasion, Android of Tara model. Looks
yeah,
a
but
bit...
those guys are just so...
I love this shot.
Yeah. He plays it so well as well, this guy, Morris Reeves, isn't it?
Yeah.
That he's like 80% just laid back cynicism and then just 20% just unpredictable mad energy. And this shot here, like it's quite an not a very naturalistic shot, but it's so dramatic the way they all stand up like that in unison.
And this is very, very, very violent.
Yeah.
Considering all of the flack season 22 gets for being particularly violent, there's quite a bit in 21 as well, actually.
Oh, yeah. They, I love the camera work here just in general because it starts with, you know, Stotts being in the inferior position and now he's the one rising over the frame.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's flipped. Now you're seeing through his legs. Yeah, it's like a lot of this stuff is pretty basic, but like it's so hard to do like with Doctor Who's budget and its, you know, setup and so on. And so when you actually get Graham Harper out on film like that, I mean, it looks... I'm going to keep raving about this, so you know, just ignore me if you want. But
no, keep going.
And had Mary Whitehouse just given up by this point? Because I don't know what to say back in the Tom Baker years.
She was back for season 22, wasn't she?
Yeah, that would make sense. She was just a bit slow off the mark, I guess. Maybe didn't see this one. These two shots, the old face to face here in profile, are brilliant.
Love that line.
Another great two shot.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean the Davison's intensity there, it's so good. That's the thing, like as great as he is as the Doctor, like he's not challenged very much as an actor in the show. And he gets the most of that in season 21, and when he gets like things like that, he can see how, because he's one of the best actors ever to play the part, and he doesn't get many opportunities to show it on TV, but he does there.
I've often heard people say, including Davison actually, that they think he was miscast. I don't think he was miscast. I just think the way he was instructed to play it was wrong. And as I said earlier, you just get these moments where you think he's playing it the way he wants to play it, not the way JNT or Sayward or whoever wants him to play it. And this whole story seems to be Davison's Doctor. I think this and Frontios are the only stories where we get proper Davison on TV.
Look at this cutting edge technology of the time here. BBC microcomputer, whatever that is. But it gets the point across, you know, the five levels or whatever they've got there. I know this is a really deep cut nerdy thing to say, but there's a light fitting hanging in the background there that looks like Delia Derbyshire's famous Taddy Green lampshade that she used to hit to make those gongs in her and all her little ambient pieces. Sorry, I promise that's the nerdiest thing I'll say.
No, I challenge you to beat that.
Yeah. I like to think it's a subtle nod to that, but of course it's completely accidental.
Now look, we can't have too much nerdiness on our Doctor Who podcast.
No, that would be insane.
Simply wouldn't do. That's the original, you know, the meme with Loki. So yes, very sad. Anyway, Doctor Who did it first.
Nice transition there. Mm-hmm.
That was a very Tom Baker line.
Yes.
So many great little subtleties in it. Saladin's hair, like android version, has a different hairstyle to real version.
I love the hysterics he gets into in a moment when he realizes that they're done for, because it's a stay of execution for him, but he can't contain his delight at this, you know. And when Davison shoves him here in a wee second, it's so kind of out of character that it's brilliant, because it shows what a desperate man he's becoming here in, as the clock's ticking down.
Well, just from this scene onwards, just desperation everywhere, and it's brilliant.
It's a good job he's so prepared to share this information.
It's one of the few times that, like, Perry's, like, you know, educational background in science actually, like, is shown.
Yeah, that's true. You don't get much in the way of botany expertise demonstrated on screen anyway. Big Finish delves into it a little bit, of course, but...
How's Big Finish never done a Perry meets the Crinoids story?
Oh, it's coming. Don't worry. They'll get to all possibilities eventually.
And you should demand a credit at that point.
Yes. Special thanks to a podcast of Spurious Morality.
I like the way he's gone to the trouble of putting a little eyelash onto his mask there, just to kind of make it a little more, just to soften it slightly, you know.
Every shot is just so well planned out. I can only imagine like how much, if there's tape all over the floor or what, to like get all the actors to these precise spots in the blocking.
Yeah. The choreography of it is really on point.
If you've ever seen High and Low by Kurosawa, that's probably the best blocked film I've ever seen. And this is in that style. It's obviously not as good, but...
I haven't seen it, but I imagine it's very high praise indeed. A little bit of foreshadowing there. Considering how new she was to the show, Nicola Bryant does an amazing job in this of, like, I don't know how she fakes absolute terror so effectively, because she there's moments where she can hardly speak, and it's not like it's almost gone beyond acting. It's like it's almost like sobs, you know, where you can't get your words out or something, and she's she does it so well.
Yeah, I mean, she's so, like, ready to react to everything. Like, earlier, the Nature Walks Picnics line, like, when Davison puts his hand on her shoulder, she, like, flinches just because any kind of, you know, stimulus is going to set her off. Like, it's a really challenging story for her in her, you know, second appearance, and she nails it. Like,
it's incredible.
I mean, I love Nicola Bryant. I think, you know, Perry is not very well served as a character, unfortunately, for the rest of her time. But in this story, she's great.
Yeah, and this kind of becomes a bit of the archetype for how she gets treated in other stories. Basically, the leered over by
right
slightly dodgy guys, well, more than slightly.
But you can. You can make that work in a story like this, where it's so like serious and so bleak. Like,
yeah,
like Jack isn't comedic. Like, he's legitimately like creepy, and you know, it's unsettling to see him leering over her. Whereas, like, when you get sort of that thing in later episodes, it's just kind of like, ugh.
They go for near enough exactly the same thing in Time Lash, and everything that's done right here is. Not in Time Lash. It's actually difficult to believe that they were made within a year of each other.
The old steady camera adds so much as well. The handheld camera just being deployed so much. This is a heck of a risk he takes here, but I suppose that shows just how fast the clock is ticking.
Although it doesn't make a ton of sense that they would so specifically program the android to recognize like particular human physiology.
Mm.
Especially if you've got Salatine in the same scene saying like, what does he mean by not human? Like, you would think anything vaguely human shaped the android would shoot. This is me being unnecessarily picky, but
human and moving. But yeah, it must just be, I guess for plot convenience, we need.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure.
It's just, yeah. It can be forgiven because it's so well executed as a, mm-hmm. as a moment.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's.
Yeah.
And at least it's not a 10-minute escape sequence just to have them recaptured again in 5 minutes time.
Right.
Hello, Pertwee era. I'm looking at you.
Frontier in space.
I love that this is very clever about the, you know, the 10 minutes thing.
I wonder how much cave they actually made for this.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. I've seen there was somebody putting together on Twitter or something a while ago, like these individual, was it Andrew Orton or somebody was putting together just these little aerial overshots of how the studios were laid out. Yeah, how the studios, yeah. And they were surprisingly minuscule. Like, even though I knew they were always small, like, some of them just seemed almost impossibly tiny, and they were clearly just working miracles with what they had.
But these caves never, ever, ever look repetitive. It doesn't look like the same set over and over again.
Yeah.
It is, obviously, but, you know, thanks to lighting, thanks to camera work, and they're really and actually doing
freestanding Jabba-like slabs or whatever they are that you can move about into different silhouettes. Now that's a brilliant shot. We do get something like that in Timelash as well, don't we? The burning android.
Yes. Doesn't a burning android appear in a cave and then is destroyed later and sent back in time or something like that?
Yeah, that's one of the really cool things. One of the few really cool things.
Actually, Timelash has a good android design.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Magma Beast time.
All right, well, we've said something nice, so.
Say something nice about time. We should make this like a regular thing in every Spodcast episode. At some point, somebody has to say something nice about Timelash.
They're actually showing way more of this than I remember. It's a shame because you can see the detail and effort that's gone into making it. A good costume, but it just doesn't. It's the walking. It's something about the thing mobile doesn't work.
I wonder if in a different Doctor Who story, it would completely get a free pass. It would have been mentioned. Now, is the Magma Beast only focused on so much because it's the only thing in this that you can use to criticize it?
Yeah, probably
because it's. It's no clunkier than Tractators.
Yeah, yes. I mean, Terror of the Zygons is a classic, and people don't bash the whatever it's called, the Loch Ness Monster,
Scarison.
Yeah, they don't bash that nearly as much as they bash this.
Yeah,
I think it's just in the nature of Doctor Who fans that we can't entirely relax and enjoy a story until we've criticized something, and then we go, there, right, that box is ticked.
What a cracker of a story this has been so far.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So good.
Looking forward to doing the other two parts. Hopefully, listeners will rejoin us for that. So, yeah, great, great couple of episodes. Really enjoyable, strong, brilliant-looking Doctor Who. And I think that I've not come across anybody that doesn't like this story, but I think it's probably the closest you get in classic Who to something that's sort of universally beloved. No doubt somebody will tweet me now going, well, I think it's crap. But
there'll be one person out there. It's like when I found out that Gary Russell hates City of Death, I thought, I can't believe there's anybody out there that hates City of Death, but apparently there is one. So.
I think this and City of Death, definitely some of the best stuff that Classic Who has to offer. That should be our next commentary, actually. City of Death is a good one. Well, we have run out of time. So we will be returning to do parts 3 and 4 of The Caves of Androzani. That shall be online in the next couple of weeks. But for now, I will say thank you and goodbye to Mark.
Bye.
And thank you and goodbye to Greg.
Thank you. Can't wait for the final two parts.
And, you know, we're leaving you on the cliffhanger of the Magma Beast. What will happen next? Find out straight away if you've got the DVD and then you want to carry on, or in a couple of weeks if you're going at our pace. Goodbye now.